Welcome to a Juno Afternoon. It's Friday, October 7th, 2022. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gwyneth Cheese for sharing your time with us. We got a smashing good show for you today. Evening at Egan's lecture series continues with watching a warming Arctic from space tonight. Todd Hunt and Paul Shipper will be here to chat about the program for this weekend's Continuum show from the Orpheus Project. We'll preview First Friday with Kindred Post featuring Sharon Price and a live demo. And the Juno Artist Gallery is celebrating its gallery artists all this month with a special exhibit. Those conversations, sounds wild, music and more, coming up right here on a Juno Afternoon. KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akwan. The Clene Di have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds, and to gatherings in other villages, and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life. For today, and for future generations. And taking a quick look at the weather forecast, it always seems that whenever I'm hosting, the forecast is always rain, rain, rain. And we have rain tonight, likely. And then for Saturday and Sunday, the chance of precipitation is 100%. There's also likelihood on Sunday of some really high winds with gusts up to 40 miles an hour or so. And the rain could be extremely heavy at times. So prepare yourself for a wet and wild weekend. You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm Boston Christopher, and doing the weather forecast is probably a pretty good segue into our first guest. In recent decades, the Arctic warmed 3 to 4 times faster than the rest of the planet. To understand the impacts of rapid climate change on Arctic ecosystems, it is necessary to draw on many types of observations, including long-term satellite records. Tonight, the Evening at Egan lecture series continues with Watching a Warming Arctic from Space, with Dr. Logan Berner. Dr. Berner was born and raised in Juneau, graduated from UAS, and earned his PhD from Oregon State University. He was a fellow for NASA Earth and Space and has a really fun title and also a really cool name for this department at his current job at Northern Arizona University. Welcome, Dr. Berner, Gwyneth Cheesh, for being with me here today. Yes, welcome. Welcome, Dr. Berner. So, Dr. Berner, I teased in the little intro there that you have an awesome title at your current job in Northern Arizona, and also the department has a very interesting name. Would you go ahead and share a little bit about your title and the department you're working in currently?
Sure. So I'm an assistant research professor in the School of Informatics, Computing, and Cyber Systems at Northern Arizona University.
Oh, very nice. That is a very interesting name for that department. I love it. It is really such a pleasure to have someone who grew up in Juneau and to be returning and bring all of their expertise back to share with our community. Can you share what brought you back to Juneau?
You know, my wife and I left Juneau about 15 years ago after we had finished our undergrads at UAS. And we were initially led away by the need to go to grad school.
Right.
And recently my wife finished her PhD and got a fantastic position with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, as a whale biologist.
Oh, okay. Are you happy to be back in Juneau with all of this lovely rain that we're having?
Oh, I am absolutely delighted to be back in Juneau. Being gone a long time made me appreciate how unique and special Juneau really is.
Right, right. How long were you gone?
15 years.
15 years. Wow. Okay. Has much changed since you've come back? Have you noticed different things?
Oh, you know, everyone's a little bit older. There's some other roundabouts.
Right, some new roundabouts.
Still sitting there.
But. Right. Any restaurants that you've frequented that you don't see anymore?
Ooh, the Fiddlehead.
The Fiddlehead, yeah. That was a big one. Yeah. The Rodfather was another one that I miss. That one's also gone. All right, so you've moved back, and UAS, your alma mater, taps you for this lecture series, and you have, no pun intended, one of the burning topics of the day, right? Watching a warming Arctic from space. Can you give us a little overview of what we can expect to hear about tonight, and then we can get into some of the more specific stuff?
Sure. So, and as you noted in the intro, the Arctic has been warming at 3 to 4 times the pace of the rest of the planet. And as the Arctic has warmed, we've seen this expansion of trees and shrubs across these northern landscapes. And long-term satellite observations have detected this spread of plants across northern lands and the increasing plant growth that has come with rising temperatures. And so we can see from the satellite observations that these landscapes have become progressively greener through time. And they really signify this widespread shift in vegetation composition and the fundamental nature of these northern ecosystems.
So you're seeing on the satellite images, is it like forests are growing? Is that what we're seeing?
It's part of it, yeah. So as conditions have become warmer, we've seen trees move out of the northern fringes of the boreal forest, creeping up northward into the Arctic tundra, climbing up mountains into areas that previously had grasses and shrubs. But that's perhaps a small part of the story in comparison to the larger kind of expansion of shrubs like willow and alder and birch that are already present in many of these Arctic tundra ecosystems and are able to respond very quickly to the rising temperatures that have occurred over the last century or so.
Interesting. Okay, because you would think, I think as a layperson, I would think more green is good, right? More trees are better. More growth is good. But you're saying that maybe that isn't so much the case.
I mean, whether it's good or bad is a very subjective interpretation, right? There are winners and losers when it comes to these sort of long-term changes. So we know, for example, as the Arctic has greened and shrubs have become larger, leafier, more productive, that has allowed moose, for instance, to move out of the northern edge of the boreal forest and to follow the river corridors up farther into the Arctic.
Oh.
You know, because moose feed on many of these shrubs.
Right.
And so it's been good for moose, for example. But on the flip side, you know, caribou are maybe the most important land animal in the Arctic. And in the last couple of decades, populations have declined by over 50%. And we know that part of this, or we think that part of this, is related to the greening of the Arctic and the shrubs outcompeting lichen, which are a crucial source of food for caribou during winter.
Gotcha.
And so while moose might be benefiting, you know, caribou perhaps are not. And caribou are really important for a lot of northern communities as a source of subsistence resources.
Why do I have the cycle of life from The Lion King in my head right now? It seems like one thing can benefit one group and then maybe hurt another, right?
Yeah, and it also points towards this much larger change that is occurring on the planet, right? We see that the Arctic is warming, the Arctic being one of the main biomes, the main types of land ecosystems that we find on our planet. And we find that there are these wholesale shifts in this northern ecosystem that are occurring as a result of warming that's due to carbon emissions from human activities. So to some extent, it's kind of a bellwether for human impacts on the environment. And the degree to which this long-term warming and greening benefits Arctic communities, it's very questionable to the extent that it will.
Okay. So I read in the materials, can you explain, I guess, this Arctic greening phrase? Is that a phrase that is used?
It is a term that we use in the research community to describe what's really a complex set of biological changes that are occurring, right? It captures, it's kind of an integrated metric of landscape change, if that makes sense. So it encapsulates things like plants growing taller, leafier, and more productive, the spread of shrubs across northern lands, grasses becoming more productive, trees encroaching upon the north. And so all of that contributes to this greening signal that we can see from long-term satellite observations. And so it ends up being a term that we kind of colloquially use to describe the changes that are taking place.
Okay, I see. So, and what implications does that Arctic greening have on the environment and animals and the like? I mean, you've explained a little bit about that, but I'm just curious if there's something, is there a specific implication that the Arctic greening can cause?
I think there's this broad suite of implications that arise due to this Arctic greening phenomena. You know, we find that as the Arctic has become greener, those plants are taking up more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and storing it in the live tissue of the plants, which reduces the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere and could serve to slow down the rate of warming in the north a little bit. But at the same time, we see that higher temperatures are thawing permafrost soils, these perennially frozen soils that hold tremendous amounts of organic carbon, like twice as much organic carbon as is currently found in the atmosphere. And so as these soils warm and they thaw and the microbes wake up because of higher temperatures, we're seeing this large pulse of carbon being emitted out of northern soils back up into the atmosphere. And as time goes on, whether or not the carbon emissions from the thawing permafrost outweigh the carbon uptake from the plants remains a big uncertainty. And so we might find that if permafrost thaws really quickly, we'll get a huge pulse of carbon up into the atmosphere that could cause Earth's climate to warm even more rapidly.
So it's not just necessarily the fault of vehicles and and the things that are happening. There's actually things in nature that are pulling, pushing, and causing some of these issues to happen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So permafrost emissions of carbon into the atmosphere are one of those what we call climate feedbacks that could accelerate the rate of warming that we see in Earth's system. And another very prominent one is the long-term decline in sea ice. So as sea ice has decreased up in the Arctic, more and more of Earth's, of the incoming sunlight that hits what would have been ice and reflected back into space, instead that's getting absorbed by these dark ocean waters. And that causes the oceans to heat up even more rapidly. And that heat then spreads out into the land.
Wow. Okay, so this lecture is happening. There's a lot of things going on, the push and the pull. Is there anything that we can do, like a normal person like myself? What can we do to help in any of this?
It's a terrific question.
I mean, I think, with not many good answers, probably.
Not many good answers. You know, fundamentally, we can all try to consume less, you know, drive less. But we also need to push for larger scale government-oriented programs that help improve the efficiency of our homes, that help switch us off of fossil fuels, that decarbonize our society to the extent possible to really give the Arctic and the rest of the planet the best fighting chance it has to limit the extent of warming that we're likely to see.
And Juneau is sort of known as a city that's kind of good on these things. What would you give us a good grade overall in terms of how people are doing, or is there anything that you see around that we in town that we might be able to do?
I think Juneau is in a very unique position of having a clean hydroelectric dam. You know, that's something that most communities in the rest of the United States, for example, don't have access to. You know, I think that the push in Juneau for further electrification is a great move. You know, to the degree that we can replace large gas-guzzling vehicles with smaller, more efficient electric vehicles could be a good way to go.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, now in the zeitgeist, I have to ask you this because the rumors are, in terms of global change, like if we don't change globally, like today, with some of these things that can impact the environment and cause global warming and everything, that I heard some weird year, like 2045, we're basically toast. Can you dissuade our fears?
I think it's never too late to do something.
Okay.
You know, fundamentally doing something now, doing something in 5 years from now is better than doing nothing. But we definitely need to be progressively moving forward and implementing changes that try to minimize our impact on Earth's climate to give really ourselves as a society the best fighting chance we have to be stable and productive and happy.
Well, you are doing the good work. I want to ask you, Dr. Berner, how can we watch your lecture both in person and I think it's also online, right?
It is. So the lecture will be this evening at 7 p.m. at the UAS Egan Library. Mm-hmm. And it's also going to be live streamed on YouTube and will be recorded and made available through YouTube as well.
Is that on the UAS YouTube channel, basically, do you think?
I believe it is.
Okay, great. Okay. And where can we find out, if we can't make it to the lecture tonight, we can watch the video, the YouTube later, but where can we find, is there anything specific, a website or something you could point us to that we could learn more about Arctic greening and what we might be able to do to help, or organizations that people could support or find out more about?
A great resource for learning more about changes that are occurring in the Arctic is the annual report, Arctic report card, released every year by NOAA.
Okay.
And so this provides the most up-to-date information on Arctic long-term trends and annual conditions, and covers a range of topics from Arctic greening to thawing permafrost, sea ice decline, to marine mammals and shipping, and many other topics that affect the Arctic.
Great. It's definitely something we should all be taking a look at and caring about a little bit more. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, okay. I think I'm excited for the presentation tonight.
Yeah,
if everyone can attend.
Yeah, get on out there. If you can't make it tonight, make sure you catch it on the YouTube. Gwyneth Cheese to our guest, Dr. Logan Berner. The Evening at Egan lecture series is tonight at 7 p.m. out at the UAS Egan Library on the Juneau Auk Lake campus. If you can't make it out to UAS, it will be live streamed on their YouTube. Thank you for being here, Dr. Berner.
Thank you for having me.
This is Juno Afternoon. I am your host, Boston Christopher. Juxtaposition is such a great word. One definition for it is the act or an instance of placing two or more things side by side, often to compare or contrast or to create an interesting effect. And our next guests are doing exactly that, using music as their source. Welcome William Todd Hunt, Artistic Director of the Orpheus Project, or Todd, as many of us know him in town, and Paul Shipper, early music specialist and guest artist from New York City. And I always think of that salsa commercial, New York City. I lived there for a long time, but I always think of that whenever I say the words New York City. Yeah. Gwyneth Cheese for you both being in the studio today. Thank you so much.
Great to be here.
All right, so let's dive right in. Todd, the concert this weekend is the next concert in the Orpheus Project's Continuum series. What is the Continuum series, and how is it different than any other concert?
Yeah, sure. So just like you were mentioning about juxtaposition, that is the whole basis of this continuum. You know, in Continuum, like, we've got this continuum of music that starts, well, with cavemen banging rocks together to right now, which often sounds like people banging rocks together. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's come full circle. But anyway, what the kind of thing that I have...
Is that sort a diss on current music today?
No, I should not do that, being a composer and everything myself. But the idea that we've been sort of exploring is early music, which I would call anything from before Bach.
Okay.
So like 1700s and earlier, and back to the Middle Ages is as far as we've gotten. Actually, this program has the oldest music we've ever done.
Oh,
yep. So that's
what is that? What is that piece?
So that's Cassia, who's a Byzantine chant composer, and she lived from, I should have looked at the dates, like 810.
Sir, I have it here. 810.
810. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. You got it. And you're going to do three hymns of that?
Yeah, three hymns of hers, which are just fascinating and beautiful and really different. And all the way until, well, a piece that has not been performed yet. It was written, like, starting just before and during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't get its premiere last February.
Oh, it was going to be...
It was going to be part of that, but, you know, the whole COVID thing made everything so uncomfortable and weird.
The
so
COVID thing. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well,
you
should look at that. Yeah, get on your Wikipedia and look that up.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, so it's finally getting its premiere. It's what's called Romeo the Wolf. The text is by Joel Bennett, and the music is by Alina Levy, who is has just moved to town. didn't live here when I commissioned her to write the piece, but she's been back a number of times, loves it, and actually left New York City.
the fish hook got her, huh? Yeah, that's great.
It did. So that's the span, like, from...
Nice.
Yeah, the 800s.
Of course, Joel Bennett, being a local author, playwright, right. He's done a lot of different documentary filmmaker.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Done a lot of things.
And has a very personal connection with Romeo. And K2's very own Shelley Delaney is going to be reading the narration that Joel wrote for
She's getting to play Romeo, right? Basically,
yeah,
in
basically,
a sense. Yeah,
in
nice.
In a sense.
Awesome. So what inspired you to start the Continuum series?
I think, so that first, so Paul will remember this first crazy Continuum concert we did in 2017, something like that. But, oh man, it was the wildest new music with the wildest music from the late Middle Ages, early Renaissance.
Early Renaissance.
Yeah. So the juxtaposition on that concert was, can you tell which is the new music? Because there was a period in time, you know, in the late Middle Ages to early Renaissance that composers were just going nuts.
And, what kind of things were they doing? What does that
like,
mean?
Atonality and weird crunchy harmonies and...
In the 14th century, especially the later 14th century, they had the Ars Subtilior, as it's called, the most subtle art. And music was basically breaking all the rules of counterpoint and dissonances and mixed meters and everything you hear in the 21st century piece.
Yeah, so that was sort of what gave me the idea of doing this. This whole series, and then looking at different aspects of that, the 2018 Continuum, the things were a little more similar in the sense that we did more meditative music, a high Renaissance mass and Philip Glass, that sort of thing. So everything sort of felt, you know, like it had a through line. This has a little bit more contrast. So we've got basically two chant pieces that we're doing. So there's the Cassia I mentioned before, and Hildegard of Bingen, who actually might be the most household name on the program.
True.
Yeah. So she was in the 12th century, like, you know, the 1100s.
Wow.
And a nun who wrote music and verse and, like, is actually a really, really interesting person to begin with.
Well, both of them, Cassia and Hildegard, were sort of ecstatic nuns with they were visionaries, and they both wrote a tremendous amount, not just music, but they also wrote texts, poetry, hymns, and philosophical dissertations. Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, they were both very philosophical women. Yeah. And, you know, both actually became abbesses of their own nunneries.
So for either of you, for both of you, what attracted you to this idea of the juxtaposition of these kinds of music genres and things? What was that initial attraction?
Yeah, well, the initial attraction, like I mentioned before, was that first concert where, you know, I've been doing a lot of work with new music, and in grad school, I spent a lot of time with early music as well, and I got to know this Ars Subtilior that Paul was talking about, and
right.
I was like, yeah, oh man, we just got to do these things together. Wouldn't that be just crazy? And
that's where it kind of started.
Yeah, that's where it all
And Paul,
from.
You're billed as an early music specialist. Can you give us a little of your background and how you fit into all this madness?
Sure. Well, it doesn't mean that I don't do contemporary music, and I've done plenty of standard repertoire in Juno, in fact, among other things, with Juno Lyric Opera as well as Orpheus. But I did study and get my degrees in things related to early music, and I've been playing and singing early music for many years. Especially, I actually started when I was a teenager.
I see.
Which is earlier than most people at that time would have started, because no one did it.
Well, now, the early music was contemporary then, right?
Well, not that old.
Yeah. Oh, there come the jokes. Yep, the old age jokes. So, I mean, and Paul didn't do it in real life, but I saw air quotes when he said things earlier. What was that? What was that in reference to? What do you mean by that? When you said, like, you got into things, like,
oh,
yeah,
yep, things that
are we talking like the when
like
you
contemporary music on recorder and that kind of
thing. Oh yeah, probably yeah exactly. Yeah. So I mean, I played Stockhausen and Berio and electric recorder things in my early career and also graduate school, and then I just started doing more contemporary and early music, mm-hmm. and the weirder the better.
Yeah. And it seems to be a trend with a lot of people, like, well, with Paul and me and lots of other people. It's like, oh, forget that 200 or 300 years in the middle. It's like, give me the contemporary and the old music. It's like kind of what's the most interesting.
And I know a lot of, like, you know, opera companies or symphonies, they're doing this thing where they do these pops concerts where they kind of take the orchestra and they play rock music, or they're trying to get the, you know, the younger people involved in music. Do you see this as a kind of opportunity for that? Are you able to sort of are the Gen Zers and the millennials and all that, are they into it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess we'll see who shows up. But I really, one of the things I hope it does is I think there are lots of people who would come for one but might not come for the other. Like somebody who is really into contemporary music and just doesn't know anything about that old dusty stuff.
Right.
Or, you know, people are like, I don't like contemporary music. I, you know, want my good old Gregorian chant.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're not forced to sit through it, but I think they'll enjoy it. I try to pick things that are accessible without being simplistic. I was speaking on the contemporary side,
yeah,
mostly. So the other piece we haven't talked about, the and you played it though before,
mm-hmm.
our session here, Still Life with Avalanche by Missy Mazzoli, it's totally contemporary, but it's rhythmically really interesting, and it's got a groove that kind of keeps it going, but it's not something that's real square. So,
well, it's so fascinating because I feel like even for myself and younger people, like the idea, but just you see it in a lot of different arts fields. Like, you know, they're taking, you know, I'm thinking of like Hamilton, taking an old story like that and turning it into something new with rap music and good singing and all that, and obviously an African-American cast. And then, you know, taking different kinds of writing and fusing it with different things and performing. You know, it just seems like it's iteration, right, of time, and everything is that is old is new, right, mm-hmm. in some ways. And so you find, and you can see the influence, because sometimes I think we don't necessarily know the influence of where something came from, but you're juxtaposing those things and saying, hey, they are actually feeding off of each other.
Right, exactly. There's been a through line from the music that, you know, the old music that we're doing on our concert all the way through to that. And you can trace that. I mean, you know, we sat through semesters and semesters of music history.
right.
to prove that to us anyway.
And there are a lot of 20th century pieces that were written based on earlier models, mm-hmm. you know, just sort of their own new orchestral arrangements. Not so much the medieval, but certainly Renaissance and Baroque.
Right. Okay, so how can we find out more information about Orpheus Project, get tickets, and all that jazz?
Yes. So the concerts are both tomorrow, that is Saturday, October 8th, at Holy Trinity Church in the Sanctuary, so not in McPheeters Hall, but upstairs.
Okay.
In the sanctuary. You can get tickets online at our website at orpheusproject.org. That's ORPHEUS, project.org.
Gotcha. Right. Good.
Which, you know, is when I first said that on the air, it's like, oh, yeah, people aren't going to know how to spell this.
I guess
it's a great name.
It is a great name, like Orpheus. It's good. You can kind of sound it out, though, right?
Yeah,
Orpheus,
sure.
Right?
Yeah,
a little
if you're
bit.
You're thinking, yeah.
All right, good.
Vein. And we'll probably have tickets at the door, but of course, if they sells out, we won't. It's a smaller house than we normally have.
Okay.
So
good for people
we're hoping.
Know.
Yeah.
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 All
right. There could be tickets at the door if you're lucky.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add today? We talked about the program.
Well, just to be clear, that every piece on this program was written by a woman composer.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, I mean, we haven't been pushing, you know, really at all. And it just kind of happened that
you're,
way.
You know
too,
what you're doing, Todd? You're normalizing it, which I think is the way. Like having to just, you know, it's nice that you didn't even have to point it out. Really, like that it just was there. Yeah. You know, you brought up their histories and who they are and also the contemporary person who is doing the music, Elena, you said, right?
Yeah, Elena. Yeah.
Elena, yeah.
Yeah, so actually next concert I went, you know, that ends up with, all the composers are male. I'm going to say it's an all-male composer, just to make sure everybody knows.
Right.
Right, and to see how, like, kind of ridiculous that sounds.
Yeah.
It's like, well, yeah. I mean, composer is a composer, and this is all fantastic music.
It's really going to be a great concert. So thank you both, Gwyneth Cheese, for being here today. The concert sounds so good. The Orpheus Project Continuum 2022. Again, two performances tomorrow, October 8th, one at 3 p.m., and then another at 7:30, Holy Trinity Church. Tickets at orpheusproject.org.
Yes.
Awesome. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Sounds wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Walking through the grass near a pond on Douglas Island near Juneau on a cool, overcast afternoon in mid-July 2022, we are startled to see a swarm of tiny toads scattering in front of us. They're western toads, the only toad species in Alaska. These toadlets look like adults, but all are less than an inch long. A close look reveals that some even have small tails. They've just morphed from the aquatic tadpole stage to this tiny adult terrestrial form. We look around and there are little toads everywhere. Thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of toadlets. I was here one night in mid-April, a few months ago, when the toads were courting. All the western toads in an area mate in just a couple of days and nights, something known as explosive breeding. A female can lay 16 or 17,000 eggs in a clutch. The incubation, the tadpole stage, and the metamorphosis into the terrestrial form takes about 3 months, depending on the temperature. And this was a warm spring in southeast Alaska, so these toadlets are right on schedule. A few days later, I return to find only dozens of toadlets in the grass. They're dispersing, moving away from the pond into the surrounding forests and meadows. For Sounds Wild, I'm Riley Woodford.
You're listening to Juneau Afternoon on KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Where does inspiration come from? For artists, it can take so many different forms. Oftentimes, the material form they use may be different, but the journey is the same. For our next guest, Sharon Price, she finds inspiration in nature and witchy things. She is a ceramic artist who will be leading a live demo in a little less than an hour on spinning earth into art. Did I got that right?
Yes, you did.
Awesome. Well, welcome to the show, Gwyneth Cheese, for being in the studio with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Of course. So it's really great to meet you. Now, you moved to Juneau in 2019 from Los Angeles.
Yes.
I spent 10 years of my life in that place. So welcome to the softer side.
Oh, thank you.
I'm always curious about folks' journeys to Juneau. What brought you here or attracted you to Southeast Alaska?
It was something that my husband, Evan, and I have been sort of toying with when we got married, of moving somewhere outside of Los Angeles. And his grandparents have lived on Douglas for over 20 years. And so him growing up as a kid, he was, you know, would come up to Juneau to visit. And so he was already sort of familiar with the area. And then he brought me up here to visit. And I immediately fell in love with the environment and the nature and just the small town feel of it. And he convinced me and then also two of our friends to move up here and join us.
So you brought a whole gaggle of people.
Yeah.
That's really good. That's really awesome. So continuing on the journey topic, how did you get involved in ceramics and how long has this obsession possessed your life?
I think what it all kind of started with was my love of Play-Doh. As a kid, my mom bought me just about every color and every contraption that went along with it. And I started doing pottery more seriously in college. But the first time I was ever put on a wheel was in middle school with my art teacher named Mihi Kim. And I learned so much from her. And she was my art teacher throughout middle school and in high school. And then when I went to college at Pasadena City College, I took a bunch of art classes there. And I had a teacher named Jim Gonzalez. And he was just this old hippie stereotype of a pottery teacher. And he was hilarious. And ever since then, I just sort of did it as a hobby. My parents bought me my first pottery wheel. And it was about 10 years ago. And so since then, I sort of just had it as a hobby. And it wasn't until last year when I bought my first kiln, I was like, okay, I'm going to take this a little more serious and see if I can turn it into a small business and just have fun with it and see what happens.
Yeah. And so it's been, so it's really been sort of almost a lifelong obsession, really. It goes all the way back.
I've always been a very like tactile person, is how I sort of describe it. I always loved making stuff. I have more hobbies than one person should probably have. I also sew. I love to cook. I do crochet, a little bit of knitting. So it's just, I love creating and making things, especially making things that are useful.
Yeah.
There's something that's very satisfying about wearing a piece of clothing or drinking a cup of coffee out of something you made. And that's not to, you know, put down visual artists, people that paint, or that's a whole other skill that was something that I struggled with. So you have to sort of find the niche or, you know, the art field that you feel comfortable and inspired by and feel like you can kind of, you know, expand in.
Yeah, you know, I was from the theater and I always could never get the set design folks because they think in 3D. So you said you're a tactile person, you need that hands-on, whereas like a painter might have a different visual representation to the world or a visual, you know, sort of feeling about the world and can express it in that way. Whereas like someone like me, I could never do what you do, like in terms of on my hand, I just would be clumsy. So it's really great that everybody has their sort of individual journey, right? And how you find that. So that's really good. So you're going to be the featured artist tonight at Kindred Post, right, for First Friday.
Yeah.
And folks can see your work there because you're going to have some things. What kind of things will you have?
I'm also going to have a big collection of mugs. I'm going to also have some spoon plates. Basically, it's sort of like a small plate that you can put cooking utensils, rest on.
Oh, nice. I actually need one of those.
There you go, yeah. And then I'm also going to have some plant pots, too.
Plant pots. Awesome. Yeah. Okay. And you are, in a little less than an hour at 4:30, you're going to be throwing some clay, apparently. And leading.
I brought my whole setup along with me, so.
Nice. And you're calling it a live demo.
Mm-hmm.
Will people get to touch the clay, or are they going to be able to do a little bit of that, or is it too messy? How's it going to work?
I mean, it's going to be just me working on the wheel, but if people want to, you know, if they want to touch the clay and see what it feels like, you know, I have a bunch of towels and stuff with me too. But
because this is I'm imagining the idea that the wheel is spinning, you're pouring the water on the clay and that whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I also brought two pieces that I made yesterday, so I can show sort of what's the second step in the process of what's called trimming. It's where you sort of finish the piece, you can trim the bottom or any excess clay off of it. So I have two pieces with me, so I can show that process. And I can show how I attach a handle, stuff like that. So.
Oh, that's really cool. And are you doing this in the store?
Yeah, yeah. They have a little spot sort of off in the corner, sort of where they have all their packaging supplies. And so I have a big tarp that I brought with me, so I won't get it too messy, hopefully.
So people can shop for earrings while they're watching you throw the clay.
Yeah.
You know, I guess. And they can also be looking at your materials there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So people don't have to register for this or sign up, they can just show up because it's part of First Friday, right?
Yeah, they just come in the store either if they know it's happening or if they come in, it'll be sort of a fun surprise.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, that would be pretty crazy, right? You walk into a store and you look back and there's somebody throwing because how do you bring its whole setup? Is that where the husband comes into play?
Yeah, he helped. Like, he carried everything.
Loading all of the stuff into the car. Because is it pretty heavy, like the base, or is it a small?
I mean, the wheel I have is a tabletop one, so it is meant to be traveled around. You can get some pottery wheels that are, like, a few hundred pounds. This one I have a folding table. I just plop it on top of that, and then I just have a basic rolly chair. And so it's pretty easy.
And so I'm just so curious about this because I think how artists work, especially in an individual sense like this, do you have a space in your home? Do you have like a separate little studio spot? Did you carve out a little closet? How do you do it?
We have a 2-car garage, and so one half is where our roommate has her car, and then the other half, basically my husband helped me sort of built a studio in there. So he built me a wedging table, which is sort of like a plaster of Paris tabletop.
Yeah.
And then a little, travel sink and a whole bunch of storage. And that's where I have my kiln and my pottery wheel usually set up. And yeah.
That's awesome. Okay. So where can we find information about you and your work? Are you on Instagram?
Yeah. I have an Instagram, which is mudchild and then _ ceramics. And website is in the works. And yeah, so far at the moment, I'm just selling sort of locally. Eventually, I'm hoping to expand and have a website set up and be able to sell from my website and ship, to wherever.
People. So those who are listening on KTO.org from anywhere around the world will at some point be able to order from you.
Yeah.
What is your, mudchild _?
Yeah, mudchild _ ceramics.
Ceramics,
and that's
okay.
On Instagram.
That's on Instagram. Okay, and that reminded me that mudchild is also like a side thing that you do as well. Like, is that a side business, or is this
It's a side business. I do have a full-time job working at Bartlett Hospital.
Okay.
Yeah, so I do this whenever I have free time, so weekends and mostly, and if I'm not too tired at the end of the day, Monday through Friday.
Well, I think it's amazing that you're going to be throwing the mud. Mm-hmm. What do you call it? Do you call it throwing clay? What do you call it?
Throwing pottery.
Throwing pottery.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess I also wanted to know this, too. Like, where do you get your inspiration for the designs from? In the intro, I said something about witchy things and nature and coming from the earth. Is that part of just being here in Juneau, or is that something in your background?
I feel like that's always sort of been there. When it comes to sort of adding your, specific artistic style to it, that's something that grows and changes over time, and you kind of develop it over years. But I've always liked, either simple line work, abstract lines, or because you always have the difficulty if you're going to draw something, you want it to look like the actual object that you're drawing. So
right.
I try to keep it on the simple side, but I've been really getting sort of inspired. There's these things called underglaze transfers, which are kind of like temporary tattoos in a way, where it's an underglaze that is painted onto a piece of paper, and you basically lay it on your piece, and you get it wet with a sponge, and then you peel off the paper, and it leaves the glaze behind.
Oh.
And so it's sort of a cool way of adding really highly detailed illustrations to the piece without me having to sit there, for a very long time trying to do it myself. And so... and then also adding sort of like, little witchy symbolisms or pagan symbols that, I believe and, enjoy adding some of that kind of elements to the pieces too.
Yes. Well, if you want to see those pieces for yourself and witness Sharon Price in action, head on down to Kindred Post in about 45 minutes. You'll be there until 7 doing that?
Yep, until 7.
Okay. And then your pieces will be on display there. Is it for the month, or is it just
that
for
I'm
today?
Not sure. I know I'm selling them there during the event. If it doesn't completely sell out, and they might stay there, and if not, then I'm sure I'll probably work a deal with Kindred Post to you know, keep my stuff there in stock.
Of course, I'm sure Christy would love that. Yeah, so wrapping up, Spinning Earth into Art with Sharon Price this afternoon, 4:30 to 7 at Kindred Post. Find out more on Kindred Post's Facebook page. Go to mudbaby_ceramics. Did I get it right?
No.
No, I didn't.
Mudchild. Yeah. Mudchild Ceramics.
Mudchild_ceramics on Instagram to see those visual images. Mudbaby. I don't know where that came from. Thanks so much for coming into the studio.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. If you walk into the Juno Artist Gallery tonight in the Senate Building Mall, you will be witness to an awesome wall of images of the artists, members of the gallery co-op. These were all done by Rick Koslerich, and he is here in studio along with Jane Andreen, president of the Juno Artist Gallery. Gunnath Cheesh to you both for joining me in the studio today.
Thanks, Boston.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely great to have you here. So let's start with you, Jane. Would you fill us in on the Juno Artist Gallery and how the co-op works, in case people don't know?
I'd be happy to. We are a co-op, as you said. It has existed for over 30 years, and so it's owned and operated by the members, and right now we have 19 members of the gallery. We've been really lucky because over the last 6 months, we've had some great people join us. So we each pay rent for our space.
Okay.
Then we also have to work hours every month to make up for it, because everything is done by the artists themselves. We run the whole operation except for a part-time bookkeeper.
Oh, wow. Okay. And who are some of the members of the gallery?
Oh, well, we have a lot of the old standbys, Nell McConaughey. Not that she's old.
Yeah, I guess be careful what you say here, right?
I'm trying to think. I'm sorry, I'm drawing.
It's okay.
Davita Ryder.
Davita Ryder, her husband Ross, also has some work there.
Lou Isaac,
who's fantastic. We have Cam.
We have Kiki. We have Jonathan Swettenden.
Nice.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes. Christine Kleinhans.
You can probably see a list of all the artists on the,
absolutely,
the Juno Artist Gallery absolutely website, right? And so for the next couple of days, all the gallery members are offering Juno appreciation as a thank you to the community. What are some of the details of that?
Well, first of all, this is something that happens every year, but this year it's especially important because the Juno community, our people here, are the ones that kept us going over the last 2.5 years. It was tight. We never did consider closing down, but it was quite a challenge to keep going. It's the people here in Juneau that really made that happen. Now that we've been through the tourist season, which has been a really needed influx of resources for us, we are turning back to Juneau and saying, hey, you guys, this is we can't tell you how much we appreciate what you have done to keep us going. And so we're offering 15% off absolutely everything in the gallery.
Oh,
across
nice
the board. Even the sale items are an additional 15% off.
So now's the time. That just goes through tomorrow, right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, it's been going on since yesterday, and then it ends tomorrow. So
right,
get down to First Friday tonight for that. Yeah, and so, and we also should mention that the gallery hours are changing soon, right?
Yes, we're reverting back to our winter hours just as soon as the last cruise ship is in, which means we're open Tuesday through Saturday, 11 to 6.
Okay.
I also want to say that I really encourage people to come down and take a look at what is happening there, all of the new art that we have, as well as the artists' portraits that Rick has done, and I hope he can talk about that for just a little bit. I also want to say, if you're an artist out there and you are interested, we have applications, and any one of the members would be happy to talk people through how you can become a member.
That's great. All right, let's jump to Rick, because we've got a few minutes left today. Now, Rick, I've seen these images of these portraits that you did. They are astounding. How did this project to make the portraits of all the gallery members come about?
Well, Boston, coming into the gallery, I met all the artists, and these are fantastic talented people. I felt like I'd finally come home.
Nice.
And I wanted to use my art to create something that's an appreciation to each one of them. So I did a portrait of each one of the artists, which I gave to them. And then I had some copies remaining that we put up in the gallery.
I see. Okay. So, and you're seeing those images as you walk in, right, when you visit
yes.
the gallery tonight?
Right.
So it's like on the front side of things?
Yeah. You walk in, and then you'll get to see some of the people, like for instance, Jane, and you can associate Jane with her beautiful jewelry, or Thais with her beautiful jewelry, or Lou Isaac with her beautiful paintings.
And where can we see your work? Is it available online?
It's available at on my Instagram, which is @shy_woodland.
Okay.
And also I have a lot of my work is hanging on the walls in the gallery.
Great. And before we run out of time, Jane, I do want to say, where can we find out more information about the gallery?
We do have a website. It's the Juno Artist Gallery. People can just Google that and find it online. It lists out all of our artists, and some of the artists also have links then to their own websites or Etsy shops or what they may have.
Great. And is there other stuff happening at the gallery tonight? I know that the portraits are a big deal. Is there any other highlights tonight?
I think the main thing is to highlight what Rick has done in terms of the portraits.
Yeah.
He sent me mine electronically. I had just found out he was doing this. I opened it up and I went, oh, my gosh, it's me. It's really me.
Yeah, yeah, that's really great.
Cool.
I mean, they look really amazing.
Thank
They're
you.
Sort of all similar in tone,
yeah.
but they have specifics about either individuals, as you said. So is there anything else that we're missing right now? I know it was a little short today. I apologize for that. We had a full first Fridays are always so full of everything. There's so many things going on. Is there anything that we need to add besides going down and seeing Rick and the appreciation sale, Jane?
Just to reiterate that it's 15% off, and please come in and talk to us about how you become a member, because we are always open for more artists joining us.
That's great. Well, head on down to the Juno Artist Gallery for First Friday. Enjoy meeting the gallery artists and share in the Juno Appreciation event through tomorrow. Gunath Cheesh to you both for being here today. Really, really appreciate it.
Thanks, Boston.
That will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Have a wonderful First Friday, and here's to a lovely weekend. Just a reminder that Juno Afternoon is currently on a reduced schedule with shows on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTO Juno 104.3 FM and KTO Juno Ok Bay 91.7. Finally,